Last night, the Crimson Tide of Alabama shut out the top-ranked LSU Tigers in the first-ever BCS championship rematch between teams that had met in the regular season. It's one of the many unexpected turns in the postseason, and here to talk about the events of 2011 and 2012, their outcomes, and what we should expect to see in coming weeks in professional football are sports commentators Josh Levine of Slate Magazine, Stefan Fatsis, who is a regular contributor to NPR's All Things Considered, and NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca. Their weekly podcast, Hang Up and Listen, where they sound off about the week in sports, appears at Slate.com, and I'm very pleased that it has brought them to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
Hey, Leonard.
Hi.
That was Stefan.
Aren't you all doing a live podcast from the City Winery on the 17th of this month?
I can confirm that. Josh, you want to explain our mystery guest?
Yeah, we're doing the podcast on Tuesday, January 17th at 8 p.m., and our guest will be Nate Silver of the New York Times' 538 blog. And those of us in the sports world know Nate as a former baseball prospectus writer, so he brings the sports politics mix.
Now, will this be the same sort of thing that you do in the studio?
It will be, though. There won't be people, and if there are people in the studio, they're usually not drinking as heavily. So that will help the perception of our performance, at least. And we do have guests on the show. Our podcast posts every Monday, since so much of the sporting world takes place over weekends, although today we did a special edition to talk and dissect that BCS game that you talked about, because really, a 21-0 game where LSU had almost no first downs, you really need to analyze that to figure out what happened. Although I can maybe say it in a sentence, LSU couldn't move the ball and Alabama could.
Well, last night's game was the last of the college season, although I was beginning to feel like the college season would never end. When did the number of bowl games balloon to, I think it's the high 30s? And how many of them are being played in bowls?
Right. And sometimes you get the situation where they'll play the Cotton Bowl, but not in the Cotton Bowl. Something will be called the Cotton Bowl, and that will take place somewhere else. But Josh is the biggest. Stefan and I both grew up in New York. Josh grew up in Louisiana, is a huge LSU fan. He probably follows college football more than the rest of us, right?
Josh, it was predicted that last night's BCS championship game would be defense heavy, but nobody expected it to be that defense heavy. Many of the what do you think happened there? I mean, why do you think LSU was shut out? Was it just that Alabama was so much stronger?
This is a painful question for me to answer. Yeah, I think Alabama was just stronger schematically, and their players, I think, just kind of out-muscled LSU on the line. LSU's defense and special teams have been so outstanding this year that they've actually contributed to LSU's high point totals by just sort of skewing the field position, LSU scoring on punt returns, on fumble returns, on interceptions. But in this game, Alabama stymied the LSU special teams, and the LSU offense just was not able to drive down the field against them, and that all added up to 0 points.
Well, LSU seems to have had a major quarterback problem. Jarrett Lee, who had been their quarterback, lost his starting position after his poor performance against Alabama in the first meeting this year, or last year. But his replacement, the Jordan Jefferson, couldn't get any momentum on offense last night either. Why didn't Les Miles, the coach of LSU, give Jarrett Lee a chance to turn things around?
That's an excellent question, Leonard, and it was one that was asked of Les Miles after the game at the news conference, and we talk about it on our special edition of the podcast today. And it was kind of mystifying. Miles's answer was that Alabama was so controlling the offensive line and so pressuring Jordan Jefferson in the backfield that he needed to keep a quarterback back in the game who was mobile, who could run, who could try to avoid at least the pressure from the Alabama defenders. But at that point, it felt like Miles was just throwing up his hands and saying, we're done, we give up, we're not going to even try anything. It seemed like just anything to change the emotion of the game on the LSU sideline would have been helpful. But, you know, that's what coaches and and assistants and coordinators and people upstairs watching video are paid to decide, and they decided we just got to go with what we got.
And I think it's almost a trick of the – if I was the coach of LSU, I, A, wouldn't eat grass, and Les Miles has been caught doing that on camera, nibbling on blades of grass. So he's a little quirky, eccentric guy. But I would have put in a new quarterback. But remember, we're analyzing it in retrospect, and it seems to us
that's why we call it Monday morning quarterback,
right, or Tuesday after a Monday game. And it seems that, well, what were Jefferson's chances of success? Zero, we think, because he had no success. But, you know, in the middle of the third quarter, before the fourth quarter, Coach Les Miles was looking at another option in Lee, who had one touchdown and seven interceptions against Alabama. So perhaps it's more understandable, although everyone who's
Mike, Jarrett Lee had come on last year in games in relief of Jefferson and led LSU to victory. And I think it was not just Tuesday afternoon quarterbacking. It was also Monday evening quarterbacking.
Yes.
Fans and the broadcasters were all kind of calling for Lee during the game, and it's a totally legitimate question, and I think one LSU fans are rightfully asking today.
And well,
their first meeting in November turned out to be a defensive battle that placed a lot of importance on the kickers. Stefan, you focused a lot on kickers in your reporting.
I do.
Why the kickers in particular?
Why did I focus on kickers, or why did they become a focus of these games?
No, do you think the kicking game has become more and more important?
I think it's become more and more important in college football, but really in the NFL. I mean, in college football, you are spread a little more thinly. It is more of a crapshoot as to whether you're going to get a kicker who can consistently make field goals from beyond 40 or 45 yards. Alabama didn't have that player. Their kickers missed four field goals in that first game, and that was the difference, certainly at least in the scoreline. That was a 9-6 game. And in this game, their young kicker made his first field goal. That gave some confidence. Alabama's offense kept stalling, moved the ball down the field, but kept stalling inside the 30-yard line. So he was called on seven times to attempt field goals. That in and of itself is a remarkable number for any football game, particularly a college game. And he made five of them and acquitted himself much better than he did earlier in the season. And that, that gave them a 15-0 lead at one point.
But many of this season's bowl games have been very high scoring. Mike, you've been critical of these offense-heavy games. So did this feel like a bit of a curative?
I thought it would be, and that's why I was looking forward to it. But what it did, I think, was just stoke the fires of people like me, I think most rational football fans, who are very upset with the fact that college football doesn't have a playoff. And we look at the fact that the two best defensive teams played each other. And I think, 18 and a half weeks ago or whenever Stanford played Oklahoma State, those are the number 3 and 4 teams in the country. Those are two excellent offensive teams. And if you can imagine a playoff, even just a 4-team playoff, and those playoff teams would be the top 4 teams in the country, Alabama, LSU, Oklahoma State, and Stanford. And you had so many different styles. I mean, there are 7 possible combinations of games. And every one of those games would have been amazing. You couldn't go wrong if you had a college playoff. And then you watch this game and it was a little lackluster. And you say, why couldn't they have just taken one of these teams and let them play one of those other offensive teams and see who meets in a final? It would be so much better. But because of history, tradition, and corruption, the bowl system continues.
My guests are Mike Pesca, Stefan Fatsis, and Josh Levine of Hang Up and Listen, which you can find at slate.com. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that if you're going to rig these games anyway, and in effect, that's what college football does. There's no standings that we go by. There are no definitive polls that determine 1, 2, 3, 4 beyond, other than the BCS's combination polls, which only determine the participants in the final game. So if you're going to rig this stuff anyway, rig it so that we get matchups that are interesting, competitive, and different.
Right. I like it. If you're going to cook the books, don't pair a starch with a starch.
There was a lot of debate about which team should have played in last night's game. The computers that ranked the teams favored Oklahoma State, while the human vote favored Alabama. So how did the BCS reconcile the difference?
Well, the way that the BCS standings work is that the polls that are voted on by human beings get 2/3 of the weight, and the computers in aggregate get 1/3 of the weight. So that the human voters' decision that Alabama was qualitatively better than Oklahoma State outweighed the computer's belief that Oklahoma State was a slightly better than Alabama.
But Josh, despite the fact that you were supporting LSU, does Alabama's win last night prove that they made the right decision after all?
That's a good question.
Well, the problem with college football is that people think that results of individual games are dispositive. If you look in the NFL, and we've talked about this on our podcast before, if you have a regular season matchup between the Patriots and the Giants, the Patriots win, and then the Giants win in the Super Bowl, people don't argue that they should split the pro football title. Whereas in college football, you have these sorts of discussions because there's not a playoff.
So you're all supporting playoffs?
And because there isn't one league, and because there is tremendous inequity across these geographically based, for the most part, with the exception of the Big East now, these geographically based entities that span decades.
Well, this is the first championship game between two teams in the same conference. It's never been done before.
Yeah, in the BCS era, that's true. But yeah, to get back to your question, I don't know if it necessarily proves anything. You can never prove that Oklahoma State wouldn't have trounced LSU by just as many points. And I think that in a playoff, you would just get more data points. And in college football, which is not a closed system where there's so many teams and they can't possibly play each other, in order to determine who the best team is, kind of the more data points you could have, and you would get that by expanding a postseason tournament, the more sure that you could be that you've chosen the right team as your champion.
And why has BCS resisted so far?
Well, the BCS is sort of the best way of dealing with this archaic and stupid and corrupt system, which is, look, if we're not going to have real playoffs, let's at least get the top two teams matched up. And it's persisted for reasons that have been, you know, well documented, but chief among them is that money, you know, the NCAA makes a lot of money. I would argue if they had a playoff, they'd make more money because
The NCAA does not, Mike. Let's be clear. The NCAA does not control college football.
Right. Member institutions make money and the bowls themselves make money.
Now, how did the three of you get together? Were you friends before you started doing Hang Up and Listen?
This was Slate had been doing podcasts for a while, and Andy Bowers, who used to be an NPR correspondent, was based in Moscow for a time and then here in America, he kind of came on and spearheaded the effort for Slate to do podcasts. So they do a political podcast and they do an arts podcast, and he had been talking to me and you, Josh, because Josh is the sports editor of Slate, and I think Stefan was the third one added to the mix, right? Stefan, you were the Ringo Starr?
Well, but Stefan, you made it NPR heavy.
That's true.
I did. I tilted the balance. But I also have written for Slate, so I like to think of myself as splitting the difference.
And also, let the record show that it was the Slate guy, neither of the NPR guys, who said dispositive.
In October, The Atlantic magazine published an article by Taylor Branch called The Shame of College Sports, about the role of student athletes and whether or not they should be paid. This is not the first time this issue has come up. But what are your thoughts about that? We know you're for playoffs now, but what about paying students, considering the fact that the article pointed out that many powerhouse football programs make between $40 and $80 million in profit?
College, men's college basketball and men's college football are college in name only, or amateur sports in name only. They generate tremendous profits. They actually generate tremendous losses in most cases because they can't draw enough fans or sell enough merchandise to make up for their costs. Joe Nocera in the New York Times also had a proposal about exactly how to pay colleges, I think he's, or how colleges should pay their players. But something has to change. It's just too frustrating from a fan's perspective. And if you have, I think it was a quote by Michael Lewis, PBS did an investigation into this, Lowell Bergman, and they asked Michael Lewis, well, is there a problem with that? He said, no, only if you have any sort of investment in the idea of justice is there a problem with college football.
Well, and the concept of being an amateur. Let's talk about pros for a moment. The Denver Broncos beat the Pittsburgh Steelers on Sunday, and that was unexpected. The Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow is someone who's gained a great deal of media attention recently. Why is he so controversial?
Stefan, why don't you take that one?
Why is he so controversial? I think he's so controversial, Leonard, simply because there are two reasons. One is the football side, which argues that he is not a terribly accomplished quarterback. He's a tremendous athlete, but his deficiencies as a quarterback are obvious to anyone who understands the game, even a tiny, tiny bit. He throws awkwardly. His completion rate is very, very low. He has difficulty reading defenses, which is a primary job of an NFL quarterback at really any level, at a college quarterback, too. If you make it to the NFL, there's a perception that you should have a basic fluency in the business of deconstructing what the opposition is doing while you are standing at the line of scrimmage. Tebow doesn't have that yet.
And the Broncos ranked 31st of 32 teams in pass offense. But, in his defense, he won the game with an 80-yard pass.
Well, and also in his defense is the defense. The Denver Broncos came on exactly as their defense came on exactly as he became the quarterback. And we all think, anyone who knows football or has watched him says, well, here's a guy who's really not throwing the ball the way you're supposed to. But he's a phenomenon because he has all those aspects of the underdog story. A, he is mediagenic. B, he was well-known beforehand because he was a successful college quarterback at Florida. C, he has this underdog story where you're not supposed to be good, and he is. And, of course, D, I think he's the only NFL player who's ever done a pro-life commercial during the Super Bowl. I'm pretty sure I could say that. So he has the aspects of our cultural conversation. So people who've never watched football but will talk, some grandma will talk to her grandchild, and it will be mentioned by a pastor in church, and he's a four-quadrant men, women, young, old type media, transcendent media figure.
And then he does that Tebow when they have success when they score a touchdown.
Or when
that's
they
become
don't.
The object when, of a certain amount of derision.
Right. Or he does the Tebow when they don't have success or when the coffee is burned or when it's dusk.
There's a New Yorker cartoon in which a guy is saying, and I blame you for the fact that we lost the game. He's talking to heaven. I blame you for the fact that we lost that game.
We've actually discussed the theology of Tebow, and Stefan has gone and found out different pastors who preach on Tebow and what they should say.
Now, can we talk about the theology of Rex Ryan for just a moment, since I'm a long-suffering Jets fan? Sports commentators have been speculating about the future of the Jets star receiver, Santonio Holmes, who was a key free agent acquisition for the team last season. And, Mike, you've said that you think naming him one of the team's captains could have been an effective move on Rex Ryan's part.
Well, I think it was not an effective move because he misread the situation. A coach has to be a leader, and anyone who's been a teacher of children, and it's sort of sad that we have to make this analogy, with some problem children, you give them responsibility and they live up to that. And I thought that Ryan thought that that would be the case with Holmes, but Holmes just retreated into his little shell and only cared about his own accomplishments and made silly touchdown dances while down by 380 points against the Philadelphia Eagles, and that didn't work. Rex Ryan is a great inspirational leader who players want to play for. I think he's I think that people don't like him, we'll call him a blowhard, but people do like him, realize that he could really inspire people. And the most basic thing about him, which no one talks about, is he's a really good defensive mind. That's the most important thing. But of course, the Jets have to improve in many areas, and on regular sports talk, they'll talk about character, character, character. I think what we do at Hang Up and Listen is try to transcend the narrative, but that's certainly something to address.
Well, we don't have much time, but we talk about defense. Stefan, during your last appearance on All Things Considered, you pointed out that a number of quarterbacks threw for over 5,000 yards for the first time ever this season. Are there not enough defensive minds out there, or has the game changed that much?
I think the game has just evolved to the point where offense takes priority in the construction of teams, and that the rules have certainly favored offenses, that have, the rules that have evolved to protect the quarterback and protect receivers with great intent and to some good effect if you're talking about reducing the threat of catastrophic injuries on the football field. So that's why we see the explosion in offenses. But we're also living in an era of some tremendously athletic and brainy quarterbacks who have been
including the one the Giants are going to be facing this weekend. Mike Pesca, Stefan Fatsis, and Josh Levine will be at City Winery for a live recording of their weekly sports podcast next Tuesday, the 17th. That all starts at 8 o'clock, but the doors open at 6 p.m. For more information about tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. So should we end the show by all doing a Tebow?
I've been Tebowing the whole time.
Tebows are great for radio.
Thank you all so much for being on our show.